The study will be used to inform the design and development of a prototype system that can help blind or low.
The red one.
Oh, we're good.
Sorry.
Good afternoon. This is the North Carolina Reading Service. Today is Thursday, and it is some date. And what is that date?
The
12th of June, 2025, and Julie Eldridge and John Federson are going to read to you today from sports section of today's News and Observer, and news from Kerry, Joco Report, Kinston, Jacksonville, Greensboro, and Winston-Salem online journals. All articles are read as printed. The content of this program is intended for you folks, people who are blind and print impaired. The noon broadcast, generously underwritten by Christine and Greg Tenzer. And at 1:30, we move ahead with our next show in line, Mystery. And I now have 7 days' worth of weather for you. And the word humid appears in almost every one of them. Today, a T-storm in spots, and that means thunder, doesn't mean Earl Grey. T-storm in spots this afternoon, 93 for a high. Tonight, 72. Tomorrow, humid, a stray afternoon thunderstorm, 88, 72 overnight. Saturday, humid, a T-storm around in the evening, 89 and 73. Sunday, everybody, humid, a stray afternoon T-storm, 89 and 72. Well, that takes us the weekend. Now we're back to Monday, and they've varied things. A couple of afternoon thunderstorms. They don't even use the H word. 82 and 69. Tuesday, humid. A thunderstorm around in the PM. This is starting to feel like summer. 85 and 73. And finally, Wednesday, some rain and a thunderstorm. What did the thunderstorm contain if not rain? The puppies and kitties. 87 and 72 degrees. That is my fearless forecast. It also is almost senseless, but it is fearless. And for your fearless sports, we will now go to Julie Eldridge. Hit it.
Okay, let's go football. Carolina Panthers, Hubbard, aim for NFL playoffs. This is by Scott Fowler of the Charlotte Observer. The Carolina Panthers know you're fed up with all their losing. They are too. To be a Panthers fan or to play for the team has been such an exercise in futility for the past 7 years that there has to be a broken mirror in Bank of America Stadium somewhere. In those 7 seasons, the Panthers have not made the playoffs, have limped to a losing season every year, and are a combined 36-80. Yet the Panthers are full of hope as they gather for summer minicamp in Charlotte this week, with players such as running back Chuba Hubbard leading the way. Hubbard scored a massive contract extension in November with a base value of $33.2 million. He followed that up by finishing with the 2024 season with career highs in rushing yards, 1,195, and total touchdowns, 11. He's become a pillar of the Panthers, a realistic option in fantasy football, and as a side venture, a promising clothing designer whose brand of luxury streetwear is dropping soon. What Hubbard hasn't done is won. Chuba, as everyone calls him because it's so fun to say, has played 4 seasons in Charlotte. He was drafted in 2021 and has mostly been the team's number one back since then. But he has had 5 head coaches, if you count the interim ones, with Dave Canales following Matt Rhule, Steve Wilks, Frank Reich, and Chris Tabor on owner David Tepper's hiring list. Hubbard has been one of the best parts of the Panthers' worst stretches in franchise history. A 19-49 mark over the past 4 seasons, which means Carolina has lost 72% of the time. Said Hubbard, as we talked after minicamp practice on Tuesday, guys that have been here throughout the years, through the ups and downs, they're like, yeah, we're sick and tired of it. The new people that we brought in from winning cultures, they're like, we're ready to win here. So we're all kind of coming together, building a good chemistry, the right culture, and it's all centered around winning. As Hubbard's star has risen with the Panthers, his lively personality has also emerged. Hubbard, quarterback Bryce Young, and cornerback J.C. Horn have a running dialogue of trash talk at the current practices. We've got a respect for each other, Hubbard said, and we love to compete. So we know when we're out here, I'm pushing for my best. JC is pushing for his, Bryce is pushing for his. And if it's not that, we're going to get on each other's butt about it. Hubbard will be the clear number one back for the Panthers once again this season. He had 293 touches in 2024, which was almost four times more than anyone else on the team. New signee Rico Dowdle will figure into the mix as well. Young is installed as QB1, of course, but as for the Carolina wide receivers, it's a little harder to figure out who's going to be the number one threat. Will it be veteran Adam Thielen, second-year man Xavier Leggett, rookie Teroy McMillan? Thielen has led the team in receiving yards in his 2 years as a Panther. Like Hubbard, he's been a bright spot, but his yardage hasn't done much for the bottom line. The Panthers have gone 2-15 and 5-12 in those 2 years. Thielen, who is 34, briefly contemplated retirement in the offseason, on Tuesday echoed Hubbard's theme. I think guys are finally sick of being the same old Carolina Panthers, he said. I think we want to get back to what they did here in the past, in 2015 when Carolina made the Super Bowl, and some of those other years when they had deep playoff runs and had the crowd involved and the city hyped up. We haven't had that. Yes, we know. We know all too well. But this Panthers team does seem to be making some strides. After fielding the NFL's worst defense in 2024, a lot of money has been poured into that side of the ball. Young continues to look more like the confident player he was in the final few games of 2024, as opposed to the lost puppy he was as a rookie. The offensive line, always a huge key, has significant depth. Goals? Say this for Hubbard, he doesn't shoot low. If the goal isn't to make the playoffs and win a Super Bowl, Hubbard said, you're selling yourself short. So that's always been the goal. That's the goal this year, and I think we're the closest we've ever been. For three more months, the Panthers can keep saying that with no pushback. Come September 7th, when the Panthers open at Jacksonville, we'll find out.
I'm going to shift us over to basketball, college basketball, just to change the pace. And this is a Duke basketball story. A prominent Clemson staffer is leaving for a role at Duke, the Blue Devils, and Coach John Shire announced on Wednesday they'd hired Preston Green as their new director of sports performance. Green, a Clemson graduate, had previously been working as the Tigers' director of men's basketball sport performance under Brad Brownell since the 23-24 season. It was considered a big win for Clemson when Brownell hired Green back to Clemson after he spent 14 combined seasons working at Miami and Florida. Green, a 1999 alum from Clemson, had previously worked there from 2009 to 11. At the time of his 23 rehiring, Brownell described Green as, quote, one of the most respected strength coaches in our business. And Shire, on Wednesday, described him as a transformational addition to a Duke team that made the Final Four last season. Green replaces Will Stevens, who retired last week after 27 years as Duke basketball's head sports performance coach under Coach Mike Krzyzewski and Shire. In Green's first year back on campus, Clemson won 24 games and advanced to the Elite Eight for only the second time in program history, and first since 1980. The Tigers also won a school record 27 games and 18 games in the ACC this season. Green's most recent salary at Clemson was not immediately available. He has 30-plus years of strength and conditioning experience and was part of Miami's 22-3 team that reached the Final Four. During his 11 years then at Florida, the Gators averaged 22 wins per season and produced NBA players Bradley Beal and Dorian Finney-Smith. He has also worked at Stanford and Charlotte, but said working at Duke is a dream opportunity. Of course, the Devils have won 5 national championships, tied with Indiana for 5th most, and this year's Final Four appearance was their 18th all-time, tied with UCLA for the 3rd most. Shire is 89-22 overall, and 48-12 in the conference since succeeding Krzyzewski in 2022. And the Devils have been a top five NCAA tournament each year and were a number one seed this year, going 35-4 and losing to Houston in the Final Four. Duke does not travel to Little John Coliseum next season, but Clemson will play a road game against the Devils in Cameron Indoor Stadium. The date and time of that is to be determined. Finally, Green said in a news release, Duke represents a rare combination of excellence, tradition, and integrity, qualities I deeply value. I'm excited to bring my experience to help support the continued growth and success of the program.
Staying with sports? All right. Here's some commentary by Jim Alexander. Now that House versus NCAA is settled, what comes next? Okay, so major college athletes are going to basically be pros going forward, finally getting a share of the massive revenue the college sports, primarily football and men's basketball, have generated for so many years. What could possibly go wrong? That depends. If you are an Olympic sport athlete, or you play at a mid-major or low-major school that doesn't exactly reap those profits, or your sport is one that is suddenly on the chopping block thanks to the legally mandated commitments that were part of last week's $2.85 billion settlement of the House v. NCAA lawsuit, there is no guarantee the gravy train will be stopping at your dorm. The $2.85 billion, incidentally, is separate from the profit-sharing component. That's the amount in damages that will go to past players, primarily football and men and women's basketball players, over the next 10 years. Current players will share a pool with a $20.5 million limit per university, over and above scholarships, with the amount increasing in future years. The breakdown is generally 75% of that amount to football players, 15% to men's basketball, 5% to women's basketball, and 5% to other athletes. Title IX challenges, anyone? And yes, there will almost certainly be fallout. The major conferences, defendants in the lawsuit, including the reconstituted Pac-12, with holdovers Oregon State and Washington State, joined by six teams in the summer of 2026, are locked into the profit-sharing agreement. Beyond that, individual institutions can either opt in or opt out and stay within the old rules, and you can just imagine where the competitive advantages will fall in that case. The schools that are not required to opt in have the benefit of waiting a year and seeing how this plays out, learning from mistakes that are made by those who've been required to do it from day one. And then they can make a decision next year about whether or not they want to opt in, said Victoria Jackson, an associate professor at Arizona State and sports historian. So what happens if your program can't afford to opt in and finds itself looking up at the programs that do? This process has pretty much completed the defanging of the NCAA, which basically will run tournaments and disperse profits from the March Madness TV contract and little else. It has no role in the college football playoff, and what once was a robust enforcement mechanism that zealously pursued and occasionally caught entities who were offering under-the-table money now has little to do. According to the Associated Press, 153 NCAA rules were eliminated to allow schools to provide direct benefits to athletes under the settlement. The new system is going to be run by something called the College Sports Commission, with assistance from Deloitte's NILGO clearinghouse, which will inspect individual name, image, and likeness deals of $600 or more to make sure they're actually fair market value and not play-for-pay mechanisms. Supposedly, the CSC has enforcement power. To enforce what, we don't know. That seems to be the last vestige of the old college athletics mindset that someone, somewhere, is getting an unfair advantage. And indeed, it could lead to influential people attempting to bypass the system. Anyone for the old days of suitcases and FedEx envelopes full of cash? That, Jackson said, reflects what a stupid business this all is and also a refusal to just admit that college football at the top of the pyramid is professional sports. Because they refuse to just outright professionalize college football, they're dragging all of the other sports into this crappier, bad, far from optimized business model. What are you when you're a professional track and field athlete? You're funding yourself through prize money and endorsement contracts and appearance fees if you're among the top tier, and you don't have to report your third-party NIL deals with USA Track and Field or the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee. This idea that everything is going to have to be run through the clearinghouse feels wrong, and the continuing of the policing of athletes that's unnecessary. With the amount of change that has already taken place, her vision of spinning off football from college athletic departments makes sense. Keep the tradition and emotion and history, but with different business model and potentially additional revenue streams. Football shouldn't be supporting those other things, she said. Or if football is, let's make sure it's the industry that's doing it, not the football players' deserved cut of that money. Jackson talked of a conversation with then-UCLA quarterback Chase Griffin at a House subcommittee hearing and of how he said he was proud that his sport helped support, for example, the gymnastics team on campus. And I'm like, why are we expecting Chase Griffin to pay for this, she said. Another possible trend to come out of this settlement, attrition, especially among the Olympic sports, a euphemism for what used to be called non-revenue sports, but accurate given the college system's outsized importance to Olympic teams. Grand Canyon eliminated men's volleyball a few weeks ago, and other campuses might either eliminate whole teams or trim roster sizes. Interestingly, Jackson said she was on a panel with an NCAA president, Charlie Baker, a few weeks ago. He told her that after attending the NCAA Men's Swimming and Diving Championships last spring and seeing the success of college athletes last summer in Paris, we should have been marketing the NCAA National Championships as a preview of the Olympic Games. Such irony. The NCAA is only decades behind the Olympic movement in scrapping amateurism.
All right, before Julie gets us over to Johnson County, I have the Cary calendar, and that's a four-pager. It's not quite as substantive as that, because when it comes to the films showing at the Cary Theater, I will only announce times, ratings, and the days of the week for admission. You'll have to find that out going to carytheater.com. to find that out, but you'll get all that other information from me right now. But first, generally around town, we're repeating several of the announcements that we do every week. Paper utility bills. Customers may experience a delay in receiving your paper bills by mail and may even receive multiple bills within a few days. Bills are still being generated. That's utility and paper utility bills. Because we're at work to return to regular mailing operations. Customers can access your online bill and make a payment at carync.gov/digipay. DIGIPAY. All right. Nothing from the peanut gallery on this. While we are returned to work to regular mailing operations, we are, that is, Cary, is waiving late fees for all those impacted and has paused disconnections of service. If you have questions, Cary 311 can answer them. Starting Tuesday, June 10th, crews began the Louis Drive Utilities and Street Improvement Projects, a major effort to boost water system reliability in Southern Cary. 5,800 feet of new water mains boring under North Carolina 55 Highway and adding 50 feet of sidewalk. On Friar Creek Drive between Louis Drive and Park York Lane, expect lane closures beginning at 7 a.m. There will be flaggers managing alternating traffic. Access to homes, the Brookstone Pool, and emergency service will be maintained, and at the end of each workday, normal traffic flow will be restored. And this project is expected to continue for approximately 18 months. More info can be found on Cary's Water Projects webpage. Well, Cary is diligently working on the fiscal 2026 budget, and there's still time to share input. and and help prioritize spending to ensure we invest in what matters most to our community. There's all kinds of ways that you can access your opinion to the city, the town of Cary. Oh, gosh. Text TXT311, email 311@carync.gov, a phone number 919-469-4000, attend a town council meeting, or during the budget public hearings, and those are scheduled for the June town council meetings. Learn more, carync.gov/budget input. Now, June 11th, Cary residents can register for fall baseball and softball. Team Sideline. Baseball leagues are open to players aged 9 through 18. That's your age as of April of this year. And girls softball for 9 to 18, ages April 30th of this year. You can visit Fall Youth Baseball Softball for more. And now I have go day by day, and I will start on Thursday with the Cary Theater, 2 p.m. today, The Luckiest Man in America, film rated R. And then we have the Cary Council Work Session. That's at Herb Young Community Center at 5, Council Work Session. And the Council Meeting is over at Town Hall at 6:30 p.m., and there is an agenda at carync.gov. You might be one of those budget meetings where you can speak out, or it might not. This calendar does not tell me that. And then tonight at the Cary Theater, not a film, but the Pride Pop-Up Chorus is at 7 p.m. It's Celebrate Pride 2025 by singing two classic songs with a room full of peers. That doesn't mean lords and ladies from Britain, I don't believe. Wrap yourself in a rainbow flag, let loose, and sing your heart out. CaryTheater.com will have tickets and information. Well, that's Thursday. But is there anything to do tomorrow, Friday? Yes. Let's look at films first. 2 p.m., Friendship, rated R. 5 p.m., The Luckiest Man in America, rated R. 7:30 p.m., a film called Pavements, and that's at 7:30. Alternately, at the Great Lawn Pavilion at Cary Park, it's The Lion King, rated G, pre-screening activities at 6, film at sunset, and that's 1994 is The Lion King, and the Cary Theater is curating it, but it is free. Then, after that, you can head to the Great Lawn for Lively Community Drum Circle, led by One Tribe Rhythms. I know those folks. They can do a good drum circle, and it has drums and noisemakers. You're all invited to join in on. Then, that's at 8 p.m. over at Cocobooth Amphitheater, your North Carolina Symphony, is playing classical tonight, or tomorrow night, excuse me, and that will include Beethoven's Fifth. Ever heard of it? It's famous. That's written by Beethoven, coincidentally. And a couple other pieces. That's at Cocobooth Amphitheater, which includes parking at 8 p.m. It is not free. There are tickets and information if you go to Cocobooth Amphitheater to find out more. So much for Friday. Saturday morning, we have the Downtown Farmers Market at downtown Cary Park. The usual folks there selling, feeding you. And crafts, various things. For example, if you want to eat a rainbow, encouraging children to eat healthy, nutritious foods. That starts at 8 p.m. and back, and that's presumably before the at least the hot comes in, but maybe not humid. It'll be humid. All right, films, lots of them. Indiana Jones and the Lost Crusade, PG-13, is at 2. Pardon me, Pavements at 5, not rated, and Friendship rated R at 8 p.m. Then, the North Carolina Symphony is back, not playing Beethoven Fifth, but the music of Jimmy Buffett and more, Tropical Rock for 5 o'clock. I don't understand that because it says it's at 8 p.m. It's time to celebrate the vibe, the breeze, and the legendary tropical songs of Jimmy Buffett, Bob Marley, Van Morrison, the Beach Boys, and more. And you may have heard about Jimmy Gibbs, the Beach Boys, the passing classic sun-soaked stories and timeless hits. Fins, Under the Boardwalk, Kokomo, Don't Worry, Be Happy, all kinds of music. And that's, again, tickets and information from Coca Booth. It is paid, not free. All right, that's Saturday. What's next? Sunday! Let's see the films. The only thing listed in the Carrie calendar for Sunday are films. PG film, The Wild Robot, plays at noon. That's Rosamune at 7134. Roz for short for you fans of The Wild Robot. Friendship, rated R at 3. And Indiana Jones and the Lost Crusade, PG-13, 6 p.m. All those films, tickets and info at carrytheater.com. Finally, Monday. And after this, we'll be headed over to Johnston County. Summer break out at the Carey Park, 2 p.m. on Monday. It's the best way possible, Breakout Park. Fun-filled day, best summer activities for kids and families. Children's bingo, meet the invertebrates program. I thought, what, Congress? No, meet the invertebrates program from the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Pardon me. And test your skills on a free mini golf course. Cool off with two giant water misters and water play toys at the Park Street Arena. And this sounds very apropos, folks. And get creative with summer-themed crafts. Grab a bite from food trucks. As the sun sets, remember this began at 2 p.m., slather yourself with lotion, for sure. There's a firefighter parade. You'll march through the park with your own handcrafted glowing bugs. And finally, on Monday, 6 p.m. at the town hall, the Athletic Committee. That's all I have to tell you about them. 6 p.m. Town Hall at Carey. That concludes our calendar. What is happening in Johnston County?
I will answer that question. Happily, I will answer. No King's Day. Anti-Trump protest planned Saturday in Johnston County. Clayton, No King's Day, anti-Trump protest planned Saturday in Johnston County. Johnston County will be the location of one of 27 protests in North Carolina against President Donald Trump this weekend. A group called Indivisible of Johnston County is organizing No King's Day on Saturday, June 14th from 11:30 a.m. until 2 p.m. at Clayton Town Square on West Main Street in downtown Clayton. According to a press release, No King's Day will be a public demonstration and protest. We are taking action on June 14th to remind Trump and his enablers that America has no kings. While Trump wastes millions on a military parade in D.C., we are joining tens of thousands of people in big cities and small towns across the country to show that organized people power is stronger than his authoritarian ambitions. Over 1,700 No King's Day protests are scheduled across the United States on June 14th.
All right, I have a brief excerpt from an article from Joe Corr Report. That's my only Johnston County report, and it's about the Special Olympics because athletes from three county schools showcased the talent at those track and field state championships, which were held on May the 16th, and the three county high schools participated. 85 SONC, that's Special Olympics North Carolina athletes, and unified partners, those without an intellectual disability, competed in a series of unified events, and those included 100-meter dash, 200 and 400-meter dash, 4x100-meter relay, and the shot put. Those events were part of the Unified Sports Program, which brings together athletes with and without these intellectual disabilities to compete on the same team and foster inclusion through sports. And from Johnston County, there's a long list of schools which participated, and I'll just list those. Clayton High and South Johnston High and West Johnston High School from the public school system. And finally, Isabella Williams, the Senior Director of Youth Initiatives for SONC, says the NCHSAA State Championship highlights what sports are meant to be, a place where determination, teamwork, and acceptance thrive. This is what breaking barriers looks like and how we build a future where inclusion is the norm. Unified competition shows that everyone deserves a place on the track. And finally, Special Olympics athletes participating are part of the Special Olympics Unified Champion School Initiative. That's an education-based program that uses sports to build inclusive school communities, joining people with and without these disabilities on the same team to promote social inclusion. ESPN, by the way, has served as the global presenting sponsor of Special Olympics Unified Sports since back in 2013.
Oh, here's some good news. Auto insurance rates increasing October 1st. Insurance Commissioner Mike Causey announced Monday a settlement with the NC Rate Bureau on automobile insurance rates. The settlement provides for an average statewide increase of 5%. The settlement is 17.6 percentage points lower than what the Rate Bureau requested in February. The agreement also includes an average statewide 16.3% decrease in motorcycle liability insurance rates. With factors such as distracted driving, excessive speeding, and increased automobile repair costs putting upward pressure on insurance rates, I am happy that we were able to hold the average increase to 5%, Commissioner Causey said. I'm also glad that the agreement will keep North Carolina's average automobile premiums among the lowest in the nation. The Rate Bureau, which represents insurance companies with writing automobile insurance policies in North Carolina, is not a part of the Department of Insurance and filed the request increase on February 3rd. The increase will take effect on new and renewed policies on and after October 1st. The agreement means that a hearing scheduled on the rate request for September 22nd has been canceled. And lastly, from JoCo, former Shoney's location being considered for new restaurant. This is out of Selma. The former Shoney's restaurant location at 1801 Outlet Center Drive in Selma could be the home to a new restaurant as early as next year. Culver's is considering the 1.48-acre site for their second location in Johnston County. Kevin Weisler, a Culver's franchise owner, appeared before the Selma Town Council on June 3rd. He said current plans are to complete the property purchase by August, demolish the old Shoney's building in September, and begin construction immediately. If there are no delays in the construction schedule, the new Culver's could open in the first quarter of 2026. Weisler did ask for a $40,000 Tier 2 incentives grant from the town of Selma to help offset the cost of approximately $335,000 in restaurant equipment. The town council did not take immediate action, but seemed favorable to the request. Mr. Weisler said the NCDOT has future plans to construct a hard median along that stretch of Outlet Center Drive, which would prevent access from all directions to a limited access. He asked the town of Selma for assistance with the NCDOT and an adjacent property owner to work out an agreement for Culver's to use Bright Future Way, a private street, next to the site. Mayor Byron McAllister told the Johnston County Report, "Our town of Selma incentives policy continues to garner attention from potential business partners for our growing community. The property Culver's has shown an interest in sits at a prominent location in Selma and is part of a major gateway into town. Having a beautiful new Culver's building to dine at would be a win for our citizens and stakeholders alike. The NCDOT planned traffic pattern change has adjusted plans at that location, but I am confident that Culver's, NCDOT, and the town of Selma will be able to continue to work together to make the restaurant location a reality." Mr. Weisler said the total investment in the property, including land, demolition, and construction costs, is about $5.5 million. Once opened, Culver's will employ 50 to 60 people in Selma. Culver's only other Johnston County location is at 11959 Clayton Boulevard in Clayton.
All right, and I can move on to Kinston now. Am I correct? Nod if I am. Okay, so I have two articles. This one is a long one. It's about a budget public hearing. And the Lenoir County Board of Commissioners will have a public hearing. I may edit this. It's 3 pages long. It includes tax valuation statistics. But I think it's there's some interesting facets to this, and you deserve to hear them because you live there. Now, this public hearing for fiscal 25 and 6 could follow with a vote from the board. And you may have heard us talking about these, how to participate in other towns about fiscal budgets. So the meeting is June the 16th, coming right up. It includes the public hearing, allows the residents to voice their views of the county's spending plan for the next year. And that year begins next July 1st, coming right up. Manager Michael James presented the proposed 25-6 budget to the commissioners on June 2nd. It's $101.4 million, and it proposes a 17-cent drop, you heard me, in the county's property tax rate from 84.5 cents to 67.5 cents per $100. The proposed tax rate would be more than Craven County, 44.5 cents, but less than Jones County at 74 cents. And Greene County at 79 cents, according to the recommended budget. Well, that's quite a spread. According to this budget, every penny made on the proposed tax rate would generate about $600,000, a big part of the budget. It accounts for the revaluation of properties in Lenoir County. These revaluations resulted in an average increase of 58%. said Mr. James, a Bertie County-based firm, Vincent Valuations, was involved in this process. Revenue neutral rate, that's that tax rate that would provide the county with the same amount of revenue. Revenue neutral is 64 cents. The proposed change in the property tax to 67.5 is 3.5 higher than the revenue neutral rate and would result in property owners paying more in taxes in the upcoming fiscal year. And Jim said, our goal is not to have to touch that tax rate at all between the next reappraisal, to set it at a rate where it's stable, predictable, and the community can know what they're facing as far as tax liability. Now, with a proposed tax rate, this revaluation of properties will result in a 5% growth in revenue for Lenoir County. The revaluations also determine the amount property owners will pay during the new fiscal year, which begins July. There was a 36% increase in total assessed value, $6.3 billion for fiscal 25 and 6, nearly $2 billion more than that assessed value from the last year. Every county across the state that has done a revaluation has seen similar gains in value. Now, tax rates for 12 fire service districts would be above their neutral rates, according to this budget. Proposed decreases include Cherry Tree, Deep Run, Grifton Hugo, North Lenoir Volunteer, Sandy Bottom Volunteer and Fire and Rescue, Southwood, and Wise Fork Volunteer Fire Department. Each fire district tax rate would be slightly above their revenue neutral rate, and each district would get a revenue increase. I'm already bewildered. You can see, if you were here, you'd see little spirals in front of my head and little suns. Anyway, capital improvement projects planned for this budget. Well, what are they going to spend it on? Here we go. The renovation of the Lenoir County Courthouse on South Queen. That has an estimated cost around $40 million. The construction of an EMS building, a whole building, between $2.5 to $3 million, and a boiler replacement and HVAC. at Neuse Regional Library. Estimated cost, $73,000. It's recommended to include a 2.5% cost of living pay increase for county employees, expansion of transit services to Saturday, continuation and expansion of the Enterprise Fleet Management Program, and funds for several roof replacements, like $400,000 for North Lenoir High's science building, and how about the Hannibal building in Kinston, $75,000. The county's debt service is going to go down to $5.3 million in fiscal year 25-6. That's a decrease of a couple $100,000. And he said, Lenoir County is on a trend where they will not accrue too much debt going forward after the county projects are complete. Let's see. County funding for Lenoir Community College has increased by $400,000 to over $3 million. That's more than the $2.8 from last year. And that increase is due to the county's own cost in operating the LCC Aviation Center of Excellence. We've heard about that in the past. Now, the commissioners plan to vote on the budget on Monday prior to the budget going into effect. Well, that's good. At this point in time, it's up to the board on how you all view the budget. The budget is available for public review in the county manager's office. And, by the way, it's on the Lenoir County website. Remember, this with public comment is coming right up, and it might be your last chance to voice your opinions on whether you might be paying more than you like. All right. I don't even know where we're going yet. I'm so bewildered. I have another article yet to go in Kinston. Shall I go on to that?
Or... I haven't.
I don't think I've done any Kinston yet. Sorry, Kinston. Great. And good job, John. I stayed awake through that whole thing. And, yeah. So, popular North Carolina author releases 12th book. This is by Phyllis Moore of the Free Press. To hear Christy Woodson Harvey's own story is about as warm, comfortable, and endearing as the characters she creates in her books. She didn't set out to be a New York Times best-selling author or to be a writer at all. But May 5th marked her 10-year anniversary as a published author, with her 12th book released May 27th. The popular North Carolina writer is currently on a book tour promoting Beach House Rules. A few years ago, her book tour included Wayne County Public Library. This go-round, the closest stop was the Neuse Regional Library in Kinston. Now a resident of Beaufort, she grew up in Salisbury. An avid reader, she developed an early appreciation for the library. She recalled a librarian recommending the book, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, from which the then 10-year-old discovered the power that story has to connect us all. She later interned at the local newspaper, admitting her first assignment didn't go exactly as expected. The interview was about a giant squash that looked like Elvis Presley, she said. I learned that year that famous people weren't the only ones that had important stories, and politicians weren't the only ones that had important stories, but we all had stories to tell. Harvey's interests and college majors changed several times, from biology to journalism, law school to finance. But in the midst of it all, in the early 2000s, she began being flooded with story ideas that wouldn't let her go. The path wasn't always clear, she said, but she developed one caveat in her pursuit of writing in those early days. I'm only going to tell real people stories, she said. Now, 10 years later, the plots and characters have brought her a great following and much respect in the publishing community. Harvey is a New York Times, USA Today, and Publishers Weekly best-selling author, Melanie Morgan, Neuse Regional Librarian, said in her introduction. Many of her books have been optioned or in development for films. She is also winner of the Lucy Bramlett Patterson Award for Excellence in Creative Writing and a finalist of the Southern Book Prize. The crowd started arriving early, whether to purchase a book or get a good seat, with many surprised to also get to meet the author ahead of the presentation. Joyce Albertson traveled in from New Bern. I feel like I know her personally, she said. I watch her podcast. That's how I learned about her books. When I found out she was coming today, I got here an hour and 20 minutes early. I was the first one here. Albertson's favorite Harvey release was The Wedding Veil, historical fiction that wove a current-day story with a throwback to Cornelia Vanderbilt in the early 20th century. I like a book where you learn about other things, other people, and she was able to intertwine storylines, Albertson said. I admire a good writer. You can pick up her books and just go away to another life, somebody else's story, get away, and that's wonderful from time to time. Leslie Foss King and Shannon Alphen, both of LaGrange, also had their own reasons for being fans. I love Christie's connection to North Carolina, of course, and read her books because they're always things I know and appreciate, King said. I've read all her books, and I love her continuity. She had also previously met Harvey in Chapel Hill, she said. I enjoy her books. I enjoy the Beaufort connection, said Alphen, citing The Summer of Songbirds as her favorite. Every one of them is, to me, is good, King said, although the Peachtree Bluff series earned high marks. Sitting on the front row waiting for the event to start, Donna Grantham from Goldsboro said she was introduced to Harvey's books by a friend. She especially enjoyed last year's release, A Happier Life, she said. That's my favorite, Harvey chimed in, looking up from signing a book for another patron. She later elaborated when she told the audience that book had been a very personal story to me. Rebecca St. James reminded me a lot of my grandmother, who had just passed away when I wrote that book, she said. It's set in Beaufort. It's set in my house. On average, Harvey is on a book a year schedule, although next year expects to release two. Typically, I have one I'm writing, one I'm editing, and one I'm promoting, she said. In addition to dropping teasers about future films being released based on her earlier books, she shared the reason for the additional release next year. I wanted to write another book in my Peachtree Bluff series, just something I had on my brain because I knew there was more to the story I wanted to tell, she said. It was originally three books, then a fourth was added. We're going to re-release the others and then have this one in hardback. Cricket Davis from Fremont previously met Harvey during a Wise Men event at Walnut Creek Country Club. Later, going through a cancer diagnosis, she found herself drawn in by Harvey's writing. It's so important that an author makes you feel like you're there, she said. If you want something good to read, these are thought out, well written, and it's got personality.
I have a final article from Kinston.com about Trillium Health Resources, which is giving $500,000 for all-inclusive playgrounds. Jones and Sampson counties have each received $250,000 to build new all-inclusive playgrounds for people of all ages and abilities. Trillium Health works with individuals with serious behavioral health, intellectual or developmental disabilities, and traumatic brain injuries in 46 counties. Leaders from Jones and Sampson and from the city of Goldsboro and Wayne County each received their $250,000 Play Together Accessible Playground grants recently at Trillium Health Resources Building. That's over in Beulahville on East Main Street. The locations will join more than 35 other playgrounds as part of the Play Together Accessible grants that began in 2015, said Jennifer McElthan, a spokesperson for Trillium. Since last fall, they have invited eligible counties from central to northeastern North Carolina to apply and receive these grants. They provide the opportunity to build playgrounds with equipment and features for people of all ages and abilities to play together outside. They include rubberized surfaces for wheelchairs and other assistive devices to travel over more smoothly, equipment for people with sensory issues, full support swings, a liberty swing that can be used with a wheelchair, and double wide ramps, according to Trillium officials. Daniel Covington, the Sampson County Parks and Rec manager, said the all new, all inclusive playground will be built at Clement Ball Park on Maxwell Road in Autryville. Covington said County and Parks and Rec staff wanted to put it at the complex because, even though many people go there, it does not have a playground. saying it's in an area that has a lot of participation. We wanted to place it there. Covington said, I like this, the playground would be put near the ballpark entrance, close to a slushy and ice cream store. He said the plan is to finish building the playground by the end of the year, but a date still has to be determined. We're waiting on a few things, he said. It's still up in the air. It is expected to be done by the end of this year. He added the all-inclusive playground is more than just putting in new slides and swings, and it creates a vibrant hub for everyone to play together. It's about, he said, building a space where every child, regardless of physical or cognitive abilities, can experience the joy of play side by side. It's about fostering a sense of belonging, encouraging empathy, and creating a vibrant hub. That vibrant hub is back, where friendships can blossom without limits. Imagine the laughter, the shared adventures, and pure delight on every child's face when they come here. That's the future we are looking to build. Then David Mallard, or Mallard, Jones County Rec Director, said the new playground there will be located on 30 acres of land across the road from Jones Senior High on North Carolina 58 over in Trenton. Mallard said the area was chosen because it was difficult to acquire a large area in the county that had adequate road frontage, county water, and sewer. He also said the site can benefit several towns in the county, including Comfort, Mayville, Pollocksville, and Trenton. Quote, this site had the best location that's near the exact center of the county, so all four towns can benefit. Architects are currently working on the layout and the best spot for the playground to make it visible from North Carolina 58. He said construction should start during the summer, but, again, an exact completion date has not been determined. He said the first inclusive playground in Jones County will help so many of its youth, regardless of their mobility challenges, and said receiving this Trillium grant is a huge blessing and benefit to all our county communities and residents. Thanks to the grant, the Trillium Playground will be a huge destination for local families and kids and will help expand their recreation and playtime opportunities.
On we go to the Jacksonville Daily News. Council receives housing policy update, and this is by Morgan Starling of the Daily News. The Jacksonville City Council received a recent update on the city's housing policy that involves assistance that can provide more housing opportunities for area residents. Tracy Jackson, Director of Jacksonville Neighborhood Improvement Services, said U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development guidelines were raised on April 1st. The average current rental rate for a two-bedroom in the city of Jacksonville is $1,300 a month, Jackson said. Realistically, a person shouldn't spend more than 30% of their income on rent. But with what the area median income is in the area, more people are paying more in monthly rental costs. For example, a teacher who makes around $41,000 a year shouldn't be paying more than $860 a month in rent, Jackson said. Similarly, a Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune mechanic who makes around $46,000 a year should pay no more than $1,030 a month in rent. Because of the lack of affordable housing in the area, Jackson said many people are able to get assistance with the city's program. Currently, in the Community Development Block Grant Program, Jackson said there are five buildable lots, four of which will be developed for affordable housing. There are also three affordable homes for sale and two homes at 408 and 410 Ann Street that are currently being built and will be available in about 60 days, Jackson said. If you think you can qualify or if you know someone who can qualify, make sure that you contact us and we'll show you how to get into these homes, she said. Terrell Blackman, Jacksonville Assistant City Manager, said the city has already been working with Carolina Statewide Development and East Carolina Community Development on several projects. There are also future public-private partnerships being discussed that include transitional housing, land acquisition, and infill redevelopment. For example, the vacant Red Carpet Inn at 701 North Marine Boulevard is being eyed as a transitional housing site by the United Way of Onslow County and other partners. That's not an easy project to take on, Blackman said. The local Realtor Association has also been engaged with that project, and they've actually brought in a team that's been doing some interviews. Our role shouldn't be real estate developers, but we should be the ones that are out here trying to help facilitate to make sure that all of our citizens have an opportunity to safe and decent housing, whether it's rental or whether it's homeownership. Jackson said the most recent homeless count for the city of Jacksonville, which was completed in January, was around 140 people, but they believe the number is higher. There were also a few items approved as part of the council's consent agenda Tuesday. In July, the North Carolina Department of Transportation is expected to award a construction contract to widen the intersections at Jacksonville Parkway and Gateway Drive North and Western Boulevard and Gateway Drive South, according to Tuesday's meeting agenda. As part of the work, DOT will have to relocate city utilities. Because of the need to relocate, the city's cost on the project has increased from $167,965 to $369,431. Water and sewer funding will offset the expenses, according to agenda documents. The board also approved an item related to the phased development of Patriot Park, located along Piney Green Road and Halltown Road. The City of Jacksonville, Onslow Water and Sewer Authority, and Ellis Development Group have developed a collaborative agreement to support the project. According to agenda documents, due to the location of the city's sewer access, Phase 1 must begin on the Piney Green Road edge of the development. However, extending water service from there to the city's water system at Halltown Road would result in an upfront cost to the development of approximately $800,000, making it too cost prohibitive for the developer. To overcome the challenge, ONWASA will temporarily provide water service for Phase 1 via its existing main on Piney Green Road. The City of Jacksonville will manage customer billing and remit payments on ONWASA under the arrangement, according to agenda documents. The developer is responsible for constructing the initial connection to the water system and in the future, connecting to the city's water system as part of Phase 2. A financial guarantee is required to ensure this future connection, which must be completed within 7 years. Additional ad valorem taxes and sewer fees will be collected once the development is constructed.
All right. And thanks for rounding those numbers off to the nearest dollar. Okay, now, here's from jdnews.com, and I'm going to implement a new thing. We're finding that JD News and other of these regional papers give you events coming up, but they go on for the entire month. I'm not going to read every detail about every event. We'll read you the ones that are coming up this week. And in addition, though, if you are interested and you want to write down and get a calendar or note the ones, I will tell you what they are and where in the Jacksonville area. In addition, this broadcast, like all of our broadcasts, is after it's going out live now, will be a podcast. You can find it in the future. If you want to hear these articles so that you can note something in your calendar, you can replay this broadcast, including our magnificent reading of things. This announcement's going out at about the one-hour mark in the broadcast. So here I go. The two that are you'll see this week in Jacksonville area, Swansboro's, 9 a.m., at Surf City at the Bats Recreation Complex. Flag Day celebration, Friday at 9 a.m., I guess it's tomorrow, at the Bats Recreation Complex. 9 a.m., 380 J8H Bats Road in Surf City. And then in Swansboro, Arts by the Sea Festival, Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., the whole day on South Front Street. Arts and Fine Crafts Festival. Many local artists and crafters, all sorts of ideas on display and for sale, pottery, jewelry, painting, stained glass, photographs, sculptures, and more. There will also be live and local entertainment all day at the Harry C. Pugliese Pavilion. So, that's a Friday and Saturday this week. Now, I'm just going to list the remaining ones if you happen to want to note them down. The Juneteenth Fabric of Our Heritage celebration will happen on June 19th, beginning at 11 a.m. Onslow County in Riverwalk Park in Jacksonville on Court Street in Jacksonville. That begins at 11 a.m. June 19th. And African-American heritage, art, music, dance, etc. Space Jam, the movie in the park of the summer. The first one in Jacksonville, June 20th, 6 p.m. at the Commons Festival Field on Recreation Lane is that Space Jam. Then the, on Topsail Island, June 21st, Great Goat Yoga. I don't even want to know. No, that's enough from you across the way. Topsail Island Brewing, oh, there is your clue right there, and Pete's Way and Sneed's Ferry will be hosting goat yoga from 10 to 11 a.m. at the brewing on June the 21st. It's a class for all ages and experience levels, and it costs $33 per person. Includes an hour of yoga and one beverage. Those planning to attend, arrive 15 minutes early and bring an old towel or mat. Tickets can be purchased at www.zenhooves.com. Z-E-N-H-O-O-V-E-S, zenhooves.com. I guess that's the goatness of it all. Then, Jammin' Jacksonville presents Signal Fire. Wilmington Band, Signal Fire, on Jacksonville Commons. Gateway Drive, June 27th, and there'll various things. And we'll give you all the details of these, as I said. Fish Strong Foundation Fireworks Show on Freedom Way in Hubert, June the 28th. And there, the cost, $5 a car, per car. Then Zing Zoom Half Birthday Bash, Children's Museum of Jacksonville, June 28th from 9 to 5, it's half birthday, a bounce house, etc. Humphrey Farm General Store, the Big Cheese Bash, all the cheesy foods you could think of, that's on June 28th, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Again, you'll hear all of these in more detail, and there's a Polynesian Festival. Let's hope that includes hula dancing, but it doesn't have to. June 28th from noon to 8, Onslow Pines Park. And the A2C Sizzling Summer Festival, Antique to Chic. That's Summer Festival, June 28th, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., and June 29th. So once again, you'll hear all of these as they become closer. Just notice those dates if it should happen to interest you, and you can note them on ahead of time. Now, the following, if I understand, there would be two pet-related articles that at least I know. You're going to read one, and then I'm going to read another one. So take it away.
Here we go. Grant supports Paws of War mission. Paws of War, Eastern North Carolina, has been awarded the Military Officers of America Association's Community Outreach Grant for the third consecutive year. Paws of War is a nonprofit with a goal to rescue dogs from shelters and match them with disabled veterans and first responders to then be trained as companion or service dogs. MOAA's Community Outreach Grant provides assistance to local uniformed service members, veterans, and their families to improve their quality of life, according to Mark Sandvigan with the MOAA Coastal Carolina chapter. MOAA Coastal Carolina partners with the Paws of War Eastern North Carolina program to assist veterans, active duty service members, and first responders in selecting, training, and certifying their dogs as companion, therapy, or service dogs. The program works with local shelters, law enforcement canine units, and veterinarians to help place the right dog with the right service member, essentially creating a team. Once the team is established, they work to pursue specific training needed to assist with combat injuries or other health issues. Training lasts up to 18 to 24 months, Sandvigan said. Paws of War ENC has worked closely with local businesses, veteran halls, and building owners across eastern North Carolina to provide the variety of environments dogs need to become useful companions. The community outreach grant was awarded in the amount of $3,500. The grant, in years past, has assisted in providing reimbursement for the trainers who travel from Winterville to Swansboro. The grant also provides the specialized gear needed to ensure mobility for those who need it during training. The partnership between the MOAA Coastal Carolina Chapter and Paws of War ENC ensures the continued success of the program, Sandvigan said. He said the program's success is measured through their ability to train more trainers, pay administrative costs, and reduce the time on the waiting list for those wishing to be part of the program. To date, the grant has helped close to 100 owner dog teams pass basic obedience training, with 30 going on to achieve American Kennel Club Canine Good Citizen certifications, and for some, state and federal certifications as registered service dogs, Sandvigan said.
All right, noticed by the clock that we are already encroaching on our Triad newspaper. I will give you the highlights of this other pet-related thing. It's sponsored by Petco, and it says that missing pets go in the U.S. every year. Many of them never make it back home. Onslow County is taking action to reunite more of them with their owners. Onslow Animal Services is one of just 25 shelters nationwide selected to participate in Network Neighbors, a new pilot that's led by Best Friends Animal Society. That's an organization working to end the killing of dogs and cats in America's shelters. It was launched in May. It's powered by Petco Love Lost, and it aims to reunite these pets with their families by getting critical info into the hands of the people who find them. And it puts photos posted on Nextdoor and Neighbors by Ring, and local volunteers also support it. To date, Petco Love Lost has reunited more than 100,000 pets. And nationally, the number of dogs being reunited increased from 23 to 24 by 2.5%, 500,000 dogs getting back home. However, the rate has still not returned to 2020 level. So, Onslow, nearly 2,000 organizations were considered for this pilot program, but Onslow and the additional 24 shelters were selected based on their lost dog data and their eagerness to innovate to save lives. And I cut out a good portion of this, but that gives you the details. It's Onslow County Animal Services. If you need to find out more and perhaps how to donate, I don't know. We'll see. All right, Julie, where are we headed?
We're headed to Greensboro. Jet Zero confirmed as Greensboro Airport Project. Aircraft maker pledges 14,560 jobs and $4.7 billion in capital investment. This is by Richard Craver. Jet Zero is set to land at Piedmont Triad International Airport, arriving with a transformative pledge of at least 14,560 jobs and making a $4.7 billion capital investment over 10 years. The fledgling airline manufacturer, based in Long Beach, California, was confirmed Thursday by the State Economic Investment Committee as the company behind the high-profile project that had been rumored to be coming to Greensboro for weeks. The manufacturer was expected to declare its plant site decision before or at the high-profile Paris Air Show that runs June 16th to 22nd. Jet Zero announced plans for a U.S. manufacturing plant in April. It had confirmed Greensboro is a finalist for the plant, where it would make its Z4 aircraft that is being marketed as the world's first commercial blended wing-body airplane. The projections are for the initial test flight in 2027 and commercial flight service by 2030. Jobs will include systems and aerospace engineering, supply chain, production workers, administrative and financial, human resources, of course. Can't go to do without human resources. Research and development, and customer service. According to the committee presentation, JetZero plans to pay an average annual wage of $89,340. In exchange, the committee said it would be eligible for up to $1.57 billion in direct job investment development grant. Guilford County Board of Commissioners confirmed at its special incentive hearing of providing up to $75.9 million in performance-based incentives over 20 years. The Greensboro City Council will hold its special incentive hearing at 11 a.m. Piedmont Triad Airport Authority will conduct an official announcement on the project at 1 p.m. at the airport with Governor Josh Stein and legislative leaders in attendance. The JDIG payment would be made out of 39 years. The committee's vote is usually the final step for a major NC Commerce Development incentive offer to a corporation. It's also typically the first public confirmation of the company's identity and disclosure of details about the incentive package. The committee said JetZero considered 25 states. All right, I'm reading this just as written. Considered 25 states in 17 states. During the Guilford Commissioner's special hearing on the JetZero incentive package, Huntsville, Alabama was identified as potential site option. The site had to have a 10,000-foot runway and close to 1,000 acres. Marvin Price, with the Greensboro Chamber of Commerce, told Guilford Commissioners that JetZero will take most of the remaining undeveloped acreage on the airport campus. JetZero becomes the largest piece in terms of employment commitment at the airport's aviation megasite cluster that also features Boom Supersonic, Honda Aircraft Company, Marshall Aerospace, FedEx, and HAECO HEICO. Putting the JetZero incentive packages into perspective with other recent high-profile economic development projects in the triad. Boom Supersonic pledged to spend $500 million on a 400,000 square foot manufacturing, assembly, testing, and distribution facility on a 65-acre campus that would create up to 2,400 jobs by 2032. Toyota Battery Manufacturing, it would build lithium batteries for hybrid and electric vehicles in what could be the biggest single capital investment in state history at $5.9 billion and 2,100 jobs. The aviation publication Liam News and Analysis reported the proposed JetZero plant will be on a 1,000-acre site with a building about the size of Boeing's wide-body plant in Everett, Washington. When asked about JetZero, Piedmont Triad Airport Authority Chairman Graham Bennett confirmed the airport campus has the ability to meet a 1,000-acre request within the remaining undeveloped 4,000 acres. Next steps for JetZero include securing an engine maker and testing the prototype. JetZero is planning for a monthly production rate of 20 planes when 20 planes a month? Okay, sorry. For my surprise, when 5 years into full production. The aircraft would feature two engines side by side at the rear of the 250-seat aircraft that resembles a Stingray. With 250-passenger capacity and a range of 5,000 nautical miles, it is designed for the unmet middle market routes, the company said.
All right. Here's another Richard Craver column, and this is about Wolfspeed, which is cutting up to 75 jobs at Siler City. And that's one of the anchor of the region's mega site campuses. It is eliminated at least a third of its current workforce there. The Commerce Department said 50 to 75 would be laid off. Now, Wolfspeed focuses on silicon carbide technology, and it is nearing completion of a $5 billion manufacturing center in Siler City. They have pledged there to create more than 1,800 jobs at the mega site where it will produce silicon carbide materials at the campus, used in a variety of applications, including electric vehicles, 5G networks, and renewable energy. Wolfspeed said in a statement, job cuts are designed, quote, to align staffing with near-term customer demand. The General Assembly in North Carolina has appropriated over $110 million in performance-based incentives to Wolfspeed. $57 million would reimburse the chipmaker for site work and wetlands mitigation expense, and another $55 million would go to Asheboro for water and sewer improvement to support the expansion. And it's eligible for up to $76 million in performance-based incentives over 20 years from the state's Job Development Investment Grant Program. Now, megasites, if you can't tell already, they're large tracts of land that have been assembled and provided with necessary utilities, such as power, water, access points, and other infrastructure. The four high-profile megasites in this region, the airport, Piedmont Triad, the Liberty Toyota Manufacturing, which you just heard of, and the Chatham sites for VinFast and Wolfspeed. That's from Richard Craver from journalnow.com.
All right, let's stay with the Journal. Pride, a Winston-Salem parade and festival expected to attract a large number of people. This is by John Hinton. Tens of thousands of people are expected to attend the Pride Winston-Salem Parade and Festival Saturday in the city's downtown, organizers say. The combined events in 2024 and 2023 each attracted about 55,000 people, said Wendy Harless, a volunteer and board member for Pride Winston-Salem. It will be an amazing amount of folks to be in our downtown, supporting our downtown businesses, Harless said. We're trying to enhance what is already an inclusive Winston-Salem community. According to a city document, the parade will begin 11 a.m. at West 4th and Poplar Streets. The parade will move east on West 4th Street and turn left onto Trade Street. The parade will then turn left onto West 5th Street and end at the Benton Convention Center at West 5th and Cherry Streets. There are 50 confirmed entrants in the parade, said Jerry Morin, the president of Pride Winston-Salem and the event coordinator. The parade's participants will comprise nearly 500 people, he said. After the parade ends, the Pride Winston-Salem Festival will begin on Trade Street and nearby areas, Harless said. A group of 150 vendors will be at the festival, as well as up to 25 food trucks, she said. In addition, a rodeo will be held on Trade Street between 6th and 7th Streets after the parade ends. Entertainers will perform on stages at 5th and Trade Streets and 7th and Trade Streets, Harless said. For the parade and festival, Winston-Salem police will close many downtown streets, said Annie Sims, a police spokeswoman. From 6 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. Saturday, officers will close Trade Street between 7th and 5th Streets, 6th Street between Cherry and Liberty Streets, 7th Street between Trade and Liberty Streets, and Liberty Street between 7th and 6th Street, police said. From 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, officers will close 4th Street between Broad and Poplar Streets, police said. From 10:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, officers will close 4th Street between Broad and Trade. Officers will also close West 5th Street between Cherry and Liberty Streets. Drivers are encouraged to use alternate routes to reduce traffic congestion in and around the parade and festival, police said. Residents in the affected neighborhoods should plan ahead, as vehicle access will be restricted within the closed roads perimeter. No vehicles will be permitted on the closed roads. Saturday's Pride Winston-Salem Parade and Festival coincides with the No Kings Day, which will be held across the United States and in several cities in North Carolina. No Kings Day involves demonstrators rallying against what organizers say is President Donald Trump's authoritarianism amid Saturday's military parade in Washington, D.C. to commemorate the 250th anniversary of the U.S. Army and Trump's 79th birthday. Rallies for No King Day will be held in Philadelphia, Atlanta, Chicago, Houston, and Phoenix, according to news reports. In the Twin Cities, Saturday's event is Queen's Day Rising, No Kings, Just Pride, Winston-Salem, according to the No King Day website. Members of the Camel City United Indivisible and the Forsyth County Democratic Party will attend in the Pride Winston-Salem Parade. Winston-Salem joins cities across the country in an historic moment of resistance and celebration, Camel City United says on its website. We are saying no kings to rising authoritarianism, and yes to pride, power, and people. Pride organizers have planned for a contingent of demonstrators for No Kings Day in Winston-Salem who will attend the Pride Parade, Harless said. These demonstrators also are concerned about issues such as the proposed cuts to Medicaid, the elimination of federal diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, and the proposed elimination of the U.S. Department of Education, she said. A group of 30 to 40 local Democrats will be participants in the Pride Parade, said Jenny Marshall, the chairwoman of the Forsyth County Democratic Party. The Democratic Parade participants are supporting the local LGBTQ plus community and are not attending the event for No Kings Day, Marshall said. However, local Democrats support free speech and people's right to protest, Marshall said. Pride Winston-Salem organizers have met with local organizers of No Kings Day, Morin said, to make sure that their message is more tailored to the audience celebrating a Pride event, and more importantly, to maintain a safe space for our community.
All right, thank you. Now, I have one last triad area report. I have a bunch of sports, little ones. Julie, I'll let you decide when I'm done what there is. We end at 1:27, you can pick if you want to read more, but I have fillers as well. So I'll read this last one about a rural hall man, Bobby Brinkley, finally leaves a Broad Street property which was branded a nuisance. After 3 years of demolition orders for his home while living on disability checks and charity, Bobby Brinkley has left his family land. Take a ride out to 9000 Broad Street in Rural Hall, where he lived for years on end in a modified camper with his wife, Lindsay Childress, and you'll see what remains of a green-colored house that once belonged to his grandmother. Though Forsyth County and neighbors constantly put pressure on Brinkley to remove the piles of trash, tarps, a backyard tent, and the fraying wooden scaffolds he had built around the camper, he said he had always been too weak and frail to clean the place up, and too poor to have a crew tear down his grandmother's house in order to comply with the demolition orders. County officials and other authorities have long wrestled with what to do with Brinkley and that land. And Minor Barnett, a Forsyth environmental assessor who knew the property and Brinkley, said, "When somebody has no money and no motor vehicle, it's hard to answer that practical question of how do you hold them accountable." Brinkley eventually left the property with what he said was a check for about $1,100 from the sale of the land and more than $1 million in medical debt after he got hit by a truck while on the side of a road. Childress, who is Brinkley's caretaker, couldn't be reached by phone to comment for the story. Exactly where they are is not clear. Kelly Newsom of Bill's Bargains, a home goods store up the road, says everything comes to an end sometime. Newsom and his brother, Bill, said they saw Brinkley and Childress last week when the couple came by in the store to buy pet carriers for their animals. Kelly Newsom, who said he remembers when Brinkley was hit by a truck, marveled at Brinkley when he saw him walking under his own power most recently. Childress had previously told the Journal that Brinkley broke many bones in the left side of his body and was near death. He lost feelings in one of his arms, and the couple had thought about having it amputated. Newsom said, "I figured he was dead then. I figured they'd take him to the morgue or something." According to Barnett, the real estate company that forced Brinkley off the land ended up hiring a contractor to haul 16 tons of waste off the property when all was said and done. An earlier quote for the work, which included house demolition, came out to about $32,000, said court files. The only thing left is for East Jeff LLC, the real estate company, to take down the house. Because there is asbestos, the group needs a permit. Work on the land is taking way longer than expected, mostly due to the strain of removing Brinkley from the land. Stephen Smith, a Winston attorney who represents East Jeff, said, "We've given him every opportunity. Matter of fact, I'll be honest, the clerk has given him more opportunity than was necessary." Barnett told the Journal Friday, "If the real estate company doesn't finish the demolition, the county will come in and do the work. Then they'll put a lien on the property," he said. "Everybody is tired of waiting," said Barnett.
All right, I'll try to finish this up by the end of our session. Another sports article from the NNO. Mavericks, Pistons to play game in Mexico on November 1st. The Dallas Mavericks and Detroit Pistons will play a regular season game on November 1st at Mexico City's Arena CDMX. The NBA confirmed on Tuesday its 34th game in Mexico, the most of any country outside the U.S. and Canada. The game will be celebrated as part of Dia de Muertos, or Day of the Dead, celebrations locally, including a variety of in-game activations, a themed court, and initiatives for fans. This is the second consecutive year for Dia de Muertos theme. Last year's game featured the Miami Heat versus the Washington Wizards at the Arena CDMX on November 2nd. The Mavericks and Pistons are two exciting teams that feature a mix of established and rising stars. NBA Latin America Senior VP Head of Operations Raul Zaraga said in a statement, "We look forward to welcoming them back to Mexico and to once again celebrating Dia de Muertos with the passionate NBA fans in Mexico and from across Latin America." The Mavericks, who possess the top pick in the 2025 draft, expected to be Duke star Cooper Flagg, will be playing their eighth game in Mexico. The Pistons, who just finished one of the biggest year-to-year turnarounds in NBA history while earning the number 6 seed in the Eastern Conference playoffs, will be playing their third game south of the border. The live broadcast of the event is expected to stretch around the world, reaching more than 200 countries and territories via television, digital media, and social media. The Detroit Pistons organization is excited to be participating in the NBA Mexico City game 2025 next season. Pistons president of basketball operations Trajan Langdon said is in a statement, "Playing a regular season game in Mexico City will be a great experience for our players and coaches, and we look forward to showcasing Detroit basketball to an international audience and a passionate, growing NBA fan base." Mavericks CEO Rick Welch said in a statement, "The vibrancy of Mexico City and the passion of its fans make it the perfect place to host these global games, and we are thrilled at the opportunity to represent the NBA and the city of Dallas in Mexico City for the eighth time."
The very talented Julie Eldridge finishing on time and under budget. And John Fetterson, well, that's just me. We've been reading selections from Sports News and Observer, news from Cary, Johnston County, Kinston, Jacksonville, Greensboro, and Winston-Salem online journals. And the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and readily available, as I mentioned, as a podcast after this broadcast, by visiting www.ncreadingservice.org. The noon broadcast was generously underwritten by Christine and Greg Tenzer. The rest of our schedule starts with mystery stories in just a moment. And then at 2, we move to Literary Hour. 3, The Greek Magazine. 4, Bookshelf. Friday, if you want to hear the morning News and Observer, that's repeated at 5. USA Today is read at 7 p.m. Health Issues are repeated at 8:30. Did You Know comes on at 9. And Sports Illustrated for Kids at 10. 10:30 brings teen magazines. 11 p.m., Our State magazine is repeated. And Modern Maturity is repeated at 11:30. And by Jove, that brings us to the Friday program, because we are a 24/7 radio service. And so for the NC Rating Service, I'm John Fetterson. Once again, thanks for listening, everybody. If you have any questions or comments, the phone number 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Such as the weekly grocery store and drug and department store ads within hours of their original airtime. To access our podcast programs, visit our website, www.ncreading.com.